So this week we'll talk about Shemona Esrei in the aftermath of Korban Bayit Sheni. Within when I say in the aftermath of, I mean within about 50 years from when the temple was destroyed. Even though it was a short period of time, it was really host to an array of developments that are important and still reverberate today. And some of them, some of us might even incorporate into our Shemona Esreis today. And it'll all come from what we learn, the time period we're going to learn about today. So that's the roadmap. Let's get started. So just briefly, where we're at in history right now. This temple has been destroyed. This is terrible. It was an anticipated event. It was something that was a long time coming based on the Jews' behavior, and it happened. And it was tragic. It was tragic. In fact, the second exile was more tragic than the first exile for several reasons. The first is because the Babylonians, they sacked the temple and they exiled the Jews for political reasons. And in fact, they let the Jewish community stay together in Babel. The Roman exile, history and historical documents teach us, actually included a fair bit of sentiments that were beyond political and were anti-Semitic. Many Romans, at least, hated the Jews. It wasn't just a political decision. It was a decision born out of hatred. And the way they treated the Jews reflected that in the aftermath of the temple's destruction. There was, I think, a lot more death, a lot more pillaging, a lot more the exile. In fact, they splintered and fractured the Jewish community. They created the exile, the great diaspora, because they moved different communities to different places. They didn't let the community stay together, and that's how we have this whole diaspora. And so, but shortly before, and I guess we'll really start here, shortly before the destruction of the Second Temple, something happened that made it a little bit easier for the Jewish people to survive. What happened shortly before the destruction of the temple, though, was very interesting. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was one of the sages of the end of the second, towards the end of the Second Temple era, and the Gemara, it's not on the source sheet because we're not going to read it inside, the Gemara in Maseches Gittin really recounts this quite vividly. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai took the nation's greatest Torah sages, does anybody know where? To Yavne, exactly, to Yavne. Yavne is a city almost on the coast, south of Tel Aviv, and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai took the sages to Yavne, and there he established a yeshiva, and he reconstituted the Sanhedrin. And the Gemara says that he did this all with permission from the Roman Empire. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was famously snuck out of the city in a coffin. He managed to make his way to the Roman emperor at the time, or the general, who was outside of the Yerushalayim when they were setting siege. And the emperor was very impressed with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and he granted him a request. And the request was that you allow me to establish a Jewish community in Yavne, you allow me to reconstitute the Sanhedrin there, etc., etc. And so that is exactly what he did. And the reason he did this was because when the temple was destroyed and Jerusalem was destroyed, there needed to be infrastructure somewhere else, because everything that was going to be in Jerusalem, and he knew the situation was going to unfold, was going to be destroyed. And so he smartly preempted the total destruction of the Jewish, you know, political infrastructure, and he moved it to Yavne. And in doing that, he was able to preserve the Sanhedrin, and he was able to preserve, you know, many of the laws. In fact, when we say that we hold like Beit Hillel over Beit Shammai in halachic disputes, it's a famous line that we say, that was a lot of the time, that was because of decisions that were made by the Sanhedrin in Yavne. And so that's what happened in Yavne, and that's Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai did. He transplanted basically the center of Torah scholarship from Jerusalem to Yavne to ensure that it could survive after Jerusalem was destroyed. And so we find ourselves now in Yavne, I suppose. And I just want to introduce us to our topic right after the temple's destruction by reading a paragraph from Rabbi, Dr. Lawrence Schiffman's book on the Dead Sea Scrolls. Lawrence Schiffman is a professor many of you might have heard of. He's a professor at NYU. He's an expert in the Dead Sea Scrolls and also in Judaism in late antiquity. And he sets the scene. And let's read what he says. In source number one, he says, "The situation facing the rabbis soon after the destruction of the temple, when the Mishnaic sages assembled at Yavne on the Mediterranean coast, was very similar. Judaism had long been based on sacrificial worship, which ensured Israel's relationship with God through the proper and orderly conduct of the rites required by the Levitical codes. Now, In the aftermath of the great revolt, the temple was gone. The priests no longer sacrificed. The Levites no longer sang. Israel no longer made pilgrimages to the holy temple. Henceforth, only prayer and the life of rabbinic piety could ensure Israel's continued link to their Father in heaven. It is naive to assume that this catastrophe came upon Pharisaic rabbinic Judaism with no warning. Indeed, it is clear to us now that throughout the Second Commonwealth period, sacrificial ritual was on the wane and prayer and liturgy on the rise. Gradually, prayer made greater and greater inroads even in the temple. Those distant from the temple turned increasingly to prayer during the Second Commonwealth period. Phariseeism, in displacing temple purity to the home and table, had helped to free the later sages from the inexorability of sacrifice. In other words, he says that this transition, necessarily after the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, Korbanot stopped. But this was not as an abrupt of a transition as we might have thought. We might have thought that, okay, you rely on the sacrifices. The temple's destroyed. Oh no, what do we do? I guess all we have is tefillah. So he says, no, actually already in Second Temple times, tefillah was making inroads. Prayer was on the rise so much that by the time the temple was destroyed and sacrifices disappeared, we actually had somewhat of an infrastructure set up to replace the korbanot. It wasn't such a watershed. It wasn't as much of a watershed event as we might think. But it does also underscore the point that now tefillah is all we have. Tefillah is the only thing left after the korbanot are destroyed. If you want to communicate with God, you need to pray. You could have always prayed, but now that's the only thing that you can do.
I'm sorry.
Sure.
So that for us to pray, I don't mean read, but for us to pray for the return of sacrifice, for the return of the Beit HaMikdash, it's one thing. But that's not who we are anymore. So I wonder what you think about that notion.
I'm not sure I understand what I think of.
That different societies have different idioms for all sorts of things.
Okay.
Ways of expressing themselves.
Okay.
Whether it's for communication with God or people or et cetera, et cetera. So I'm wondering what you think about how easy would it be for us to go back to sacrifices? Do you think that's it?
How easy it would be.
Yeah. Oh, it seems so like a foreign to us.
I understand. So there is a discussion, there's a rabbinic discussion about whether we will return to sacrifices. That is an opinion that there are some rabbis who do espouse, in which case the third Beit HaMikdash will not have animal sacrifices. Other rabbis think that that's heretical. It's a matter of dispute. So I do think that there's room to say such a thing, and it seems so foreign to us. But the truth is that, and probably the majority opinion is certainly, and I guess we'll see it when it happens, but the majority opinion is certainly to expect and to anticipate the return of sacrifices. It's important to remember that a lot of these sacrifices were eaten, and there isn't so much of a difference necessarily, meaning you're just not there when the animal is killed. But the animal is being killed and you're eating meat. Most of the people here presumably are eating meat regardless. I'm not sure it would be that drastic of a difference, but I could be wrong. In fact, I once saw a depiction of the third Beit HaMikdash, and there was a light rail stop right next to it. It was like a digitally rendered picture, and there was a light rail stop right next to it, and there were heated floors for the feet of the Kohanim. The Kohanim had to walk barefoot and put in stone. It's cold in Jerusalem in the winter. And it was a little bit jarring to see that. But I think that, you know, everything new can be jarring, and I think that with time, I would hope, if this is really something that God wants us to be doing, it would become comfortable. Okay. So here we are at Yavne. Here we are at Yavne. The temple has been destroyed, and tefillah is now the only thing that we have. And so studying the development of tefillah, this is huge. This is worth taking note of. This is the first time since sacrifices were instituted that we only had tefillah. And it's been, you know, several centuries since the second Beit HaMikdash was established. These sacrifices were in play for a long time. But there's also something else that happens in Yavne. It's not just the Sanhedrin, and it's not just the Center of Torah Scholarship. There are specific things that take place there. And this is one of them. If you read in the Gemara in Megillah, it actually calls into question a lot of the things that we learned. It's a fascinating Gemara in Megillah. D'tanya Shimon, and Daf Yud Zayin Amud Bet, to Yudcher Amud Aleph, in source number 2. D'tanya Shimon Hapakuli, Histir Shimon Esrei Brachot, Lifnei Rabban Gamliel, Ahasheder B'Yavin. B'Yavne. In Yavne, Shimon Hapakuli, one of the rabbis, was Masdir, Histir. He arranged the 18 benedictions before Rabban Gamliel in Yavne in the aftermath of the temple's destruction. Okay. Now, what does that mean that Shimon HaPikuli histir the Shimon Esrei Brachot? What does it mean to arrange the blessings? Didn't we have all these blessings? Didn't we learn that Shimon Esrei was established by the Anshei Knesset HaGedola? Is that not what we learned? So Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yochanan said, we learned, we saw this Gemara, we saw these sources, that there was 120 elders, meaning the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, meaning Ezra and his Beit Din, established the Shimon Esrei. Right? That's what we learned 2 times ago. When we met, we read about how Ezra and his Beit Din established the Shimon Esrei. So Rabbi Yochanan asks, "V'chi me'achar de'me'a ve'esrim zekeinim who me'ham kamet avim tiknu tefila al haseder." Well, if it was really the Anshei Knesset HaGedola and the associated parties that established Shimon Esrei, well then, Shimon HaPikuli my histir. What was left for Shimon HaPikuli to do? What did he do when the Gemara says that he was arranging the brachos? So the Gemara says something very, very strange. The Gemara says, Shechachum v'chazar v'sidrum. The people forgot them, and Shimon HaPikuli brought them back. He retaught them to the people, he retaught them to Rabban Gamliel, and so the people were able to relearn the Shimon Esrei. Okay. So this is very strange. This is very strange. It answers the question about what Shimon HaPikuli did, but it raises more questions than it answers. You have, what are your questions? I'm curious. What are your questions? Anybody have a question? How could they forget? If the Shimon Esrei was something they were obligated to say every single day, how could an entire nation of people have forgotten the liturgy that they were using to daven every day? It's astonishing. That's like saying every single, you know, tons of people, all of a sudden, they don't remember a thing. How could they forget? Excellent question. Excellent question. Yeah?
Also, if it was already in place, why do we have to rearrange it? It says he arranged it. Did he change the order?
Great question. What you're asking is, what does it mean to arrange something that already existed? You know, it's like saying, how do you set a table that's already set? Right, exactly. Exactly. What does it mean? It says histir. Now, English translates it as arranged. The Steinsaltz Talmud, where I probably copy and pasted the English translation from, translates it as arranged. But we don't know. Histir is a little bit of an ambiguous word. Lesader, lehasdir, means to I guess it really does literally mean to arrange. But, what?
To order,
yeah. But your question stands, meaning if it was already arranged, if it was already ordered. Well, how do you reorder something that's already ordered? So excellent questions. How could a people forget something they've been reciting for almost half a millennium? And B, what does it mean to arrange? What did Shimon HaPikuli do that didn't already happen, that didn't already exist? Okay, so I think that the answers, I want to emphasize something. I think that the answers to these questions can teach us something important and ultimately answer a question from last week. Last week, our question was, how people could have davened for what were anachronisms. How could they in temple times, if they used the Shimon Esrei that we have today, what emerges is that they were davening for the return of the Sanhedrin, and they were davening for the reinstitution of sacrifices, and they were but the truth is that they had all of those things. So how, if the Anshei Knesset HaGedola really established Shimon Esrei, and people were using it in temple times, well, how were they davening then for things that they already had? It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. So I think that we are going to answer the 2 questions that we just posed, and that will help us answer our question that is still standing from last week. So I want to answer the second question first. The second question was, what did Shimon HaPikuli do? What did he do in Yavne? What was he master? What did he do? So that will give us, I think, the answer to the first question. The answer to the second question will give us the answer to the first question. And it starts with a sefer called the Asher Lemelech. I'm assuming not many people have heard of the Asher. Anybody heard of the Asher Lemelech? Be very surprised. It's a very obscure sefer. Rabbi Asher Lemelech is a commentary on the Rambam that was written by a certain Rabbi Asher Feichtunger. Rabbi Asher Feichtunger was a Hungarian-born rabbi who served as a rav in England in Letchworth. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. I hope I am. It's a little bit of a suburb of England, but it's a little bit too far to be a suburb. It's basically what Trenton is to Philadelphia, I would say. Letchworth is to London, okay? So... What?
It was the first model
Newtown. Oh, yeah? Oh, interesting. Okay. So he was a Rav in Letchworth, England, and he later moved to Jerusalem. He was a very obscure figure. In fact, all of the information that I'm telling you right now, I gathered from... he's buried somewhere, I think, on Har HaMenuchot. And so they have these registries of all the Kivarim on Har HaMenuchot and what it says on their graves. And all this information is on his grave. There is no Wikipedia page about Rabbi Asher Feichtunger. There is no... it was very hard to find information, but I found information on his kever. So that's what we have. And we're about to learn his Torah. And so he wrote a commentary on part of the Rambam's Mishneh Torah called the Asher Lemelech. And this is something he writes in that Sefer Asher Lemelech in source number three. He says something that's really fascinating. It's something we haven't seen before. And it really suggests perhaps a radical rethinking of the Takana, of the Shemona Esrei. He says, V'nira de Takanat Ezra, the last source on page 3. It appears that the decree of Ezra, meaning the Anshei Knesset Hagadol, when we say Ezra's decree, Ezra and his Beit Din, Me'av Esrim Zekanim, Anshei Knesset Hagadola, those are all the same. We all were referring to the same people. It's the Anshei Knesset Hagadola who established this decree of Shemona Esrei, Hayita Rak Bishvil Elu Shalosh Shaltu Kara'oi Belashon HaKodesh. That was only for the people who were not proficient in the Hebrew tongue. We had read that according to the Rambam, and this is where he gets this from, according to the Rambam, the reason the Shemona Esrei needed to be instituted is because in exile, during the first exile, people lost their ability to speak Hebrew fluently. And it wasn't respectful to come before God, the King of all kings, in a mishmash of languages. And so what he says here is that Rabbi Asher Feichtunger takes it a step further. He says, not only was the lack of proficiency in Hebrew the reason for the decree of the Shemona Esrei, it was actually only applicable to people who did not speak Hebrew proficiently. And then he says, "Umeaz shechazra ateret lishonenu liyoshena b'yemei bayit sheni." And then once our second temple was rebuilt, the first exile ended, we regained our holy land and our holy places, and we were free to speak and practice and worship as we wanted. Hebrew grew again in popularity and proficiency, and then it became the dominant language. Well, if Hebrew was now the dominant language, and the decree of the Shemona Esrei was only instituted for people who no longer spoke Hebrew, then what emerges from this, is that nobody was obligated to daven the Shemona Esrei anymore. If the Shemona Esrei was only instituted for people that did not speak Hebrew proficiently, but then everybody started speaking Hebrew proficiently again, the more people spoke Hebrew, the less Shemona Esrei was recited. And so as Bayit Sheni picked up speed and we started resuming our sacrifices and we started restoring the language that we had spoken, we had no longer any obligation to recite Shemona Esrei. Yeah.
So am I
concluding
correctly what you're saying, that when we couldn't express ourselves in Hebrew, we had this formulaic way, in other words, this is what you should say because you don't know what to say. Once we knew how to express ourselves, it sounds like we now were saying our own free will, expression, rather than something we all say the same thing.
Correct. So Shemona Esrei, the problem Shemona Esrei came to answer, according to the Rambam, was that people were not praying properly. Because they did not speak Hebrew, and he writes they didn't really speak any language fluently, and they were just speaking a mixture of different languages. And then you go to the king and you say one thing in one language, one thing in another language, you don't look very presentable. And that's not okay to not look presentable before God. So they established the Shemona Esrei so that people could present themselves well to God. But when people stopped needing the Shemona Esrei, then it stopped being obligatory. Yes, and now you can go back to davening whatever you would like. And in fact, it only ever, and the people who spoke Hebrew even in the days of the exile were always able to do that. The decree only applied to people who were not proficient enough in Hebrew. Or really, maybe according to the Rambam, in any one language that they could use to speak respectfully towards God. Exactly. So that's what he says. And then he concludes, okay. Well, then what happened was, obviously, if everybody stopped reciting, if Shemona Esrei was only there so that people who didn't speak Hebrew were able to say something to God in a respectful manner, and then when everybody started speaking Hebrew again, Shemona Esrei basically never applied to anyone anymore. Well, in that case, HaNusach HaYayachol Yishtakeach. Then it makes a lot of sense, because then, over the course of 500 years, if people stopped doing something, of course, at the end of half a millennium, nobody's going to remember the original text anymore. V'rak mikoach takanat Shimon ha'pekuli nitchayavu kol Yisrael letovat ta'ilogim lehitpalel benusach achid. And what did Shimon ha'pekuli do? What did he do? He, when it says his there, he obligated, he reinstituted Shemona Esrei as an obligation. So what happens is that Shemona Esrei used to be obligatory for some people. It then ceased to be obligatory for anyone just by virtue of the fact that everybody spoke Hebrew. And then in the aftermath of Bayit Sheni, the destruction of Bayit Sheni, Shimon HaPekuli made it applicable to everyone. And the Shemona Esrei that we are obligated to say now is because of that takana of Shimon HaPekuli. So he answers both questions. He answers, what does hisdir mean? It means that Shimon HaPekuli made it into an obligation. And he needed to arrange it because everybody had forgotten it. And why? How could people have forgotten something? That was your question. How could people have forgotten something that they were reciting every day? He would answer, they were not reciting it every day. That was only at the very beginning of Bayit Sheni times. And then when people started speaking Hebrew, they stopped needing to daven at Shemona Esrei. Does that make sense? Is he making sense? Okay, good. Great. So, yeah. So what Shimon HaPekuli did was he made it a blanket obligation. Shimon HaPekuli did as he said, it doesn't matter whether you can or can't speak Hebrew, that's probably, we have no more korbanot, this is the only thing we have left, I'm going to make it obligatory then for everyone. This is going to be the new way you communicate with God. This is going to become now the default. Lawrence Schiffman said it was already quickly becoming the default, but this was the takana that made it the default, according to the Asher Lemelech, according to Rabbi Asher Feichtunger. And so, this helps us also, by the way, help us understand, the last time we met, we reviewed a Mishnah. The Mishnah had said that the Kohanim, maybe you remember this, it'll be good Chazara, the Mishnah had said that the Kohanim recite Birkas Kohanim and Shema and one or two blessings from the Shemona Esrei in their Avoda. So it also answers that question, which is that the Kohanim were regular people. If the Shemona Esrei was obligatory, they should have had to say all of it. How can they get away with only saying part of it? Ah, well, if you say it was never obligatory unless you didn't speak Hebrew, then the Kohanim who were speaking Hebrew were not obligated to say all of it. And you can answer that. Kasha. This is radical, because we thought that there was a streamlined process. We thought tefillah meandered along until the establishment of the Shemona Esrei. And I think we, over the course of the many past weeks, we've tried to dispel that notion and saw that even before the establishment of Shemona Esrei, there were inklings of formalization and institutionalization of tefillah. But the truth is that even after the Shemona Esrei was created, that's not the end of the story. It wasn't obligatory until Shimon HaPekuli made it obligatory. And that's what it means. He was histir et habrachot. He turned the custom into a formal obligation. And it is only because of Shimon HaPekuli that we are obligated to recite Shemona Esrei nowadays. Yeah. So, meaning
that Hebrew shouldn't be spoken.
That's a good question. The truth is, the Rambam writes in his Perush HaMishnayos that it's a mitzvah to learn Hebrew. It's called a mitzvah kala. That's a light mitzvah to learn Hebrew. I don't know. I'm not so familiar with the history. I mean, by the time Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, the Satmar Rav, was around, he was very much, he didn't even think Hebrew was Lashon HaKodesh. He thought there were two different languages. He called Ivrit and Lashon HaKodesh two different things. He actually has a whole treatise on this. He wrote a book about it. And, I mean, part of it was about Zionism and going up to Israel, and it was against that. And part of it was about the Hebrew language. But I don't know what the genesis of that was. Okay. So let's look at one more answer to this question of what exactly Shimon HaPikuli did in Yavne. And this one comes to us courtesy of Rabbi Chaim Yehuda Ehrenreich. Rabbi Ehrenreich, maybe some of you, anybody been to Stamford, Connecticut? Rabbi Aaron Kranz? No? Okay. What?
My sister lives in Stamford.
Oh yeah, so he was Nifter, but they're not related. I wanted to make a joke. No, they're not related. But it's a similar name. Rabbi Ehrenreich, Rabbi Chaim Yehuda Ehrenreich, was a Rav. He was born in 1887. He was Nifter in 1942. He was a Moravian rabbi and a Slovakian rabbi. And he wrote a commentary on the Abudraham. The Abudraham is an early medieval work. And so this is something he writes, and it's my favorite answer. Actually, it might be one of my favorite sources that we've done so far together as a group. And he has another suggestion as to what exactly Shimon HaPikuli did when it says that Shimon HaPikuli was Mastir the Shimon HaEsrei. So he says, Shimon HaPikuli my Histir? That was the question of the Gemara. What did Shimon HaPikuli rearrange? The Gemara said they forgot it and he rearranged it. But Rabbi Ehrenreich says something interesting. This is in his commentary on the Abudraham and in, Arachav Beis. He says, "Be'emet eno she'ela." That is actually not a real question. There's no question there. Why? Why? What did Shimon HaPikuli do? Ki be'emei anshe Knesset Hagadola, in the days of the anshe Knesset Hagadola, haya behechrech nusach harbe brachot be'ofen acher mimashehu bi'adenu hayom. The language, the wording of many brachas must have been very different than the one that we use today. Why? Ki harbe brachot lo haya lehem makom bizman anshe Knesset Hagadola. Because many of the blessings that we recite today had no place in the liturgy of the Bayit Sheni people. Well, l'mashal, he says, nusach berchas hashiva shofteinu, like hashiva shofteinu, the commandment to the bracha that we're going to restore the Sanhedrin. They had the Sanhedrin. In fact, it was the Sanhedrin that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai moved to Yavne. It was in existence during these times. So he says, first of all, it must be that the tefillot that we have nowadays are very different than the tefillot that they had. Okay. Lefize, haya l'Shimon HaPikuli avodah rabba. Shimon HaPikuli had his work cut out for him. He had to change, he had to add to, he had to remove from the formulations of the various blessings, and change that which was written in the days of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, in order to comport with the contemporary times when these blessings were no longer relevant. So what did Shimon HaPikuli do according to Rav Ehrenreich? What does it mean he was histir? It means that he rearranged the brachot and he changed around the languages so that it made sense after the temple, because they were not, we after the temple, we needed to daven for Hashiva Shofteinu, because we had lot. Well, they still had it at that immediate moment, but they needed to daven for the temple service to resume. But Shimon HaPikuli, and that's exactly what, and he really davened Hashiva Shofteinu Kvar Rishonai, even when it was in Yavne. It was not as it was in its former days. So the truth is, Rabbi Shimon HaPikuli, what did he do? My Histir, Rabbi Ehrenreich said, Rabbi the Asher Lamelech says, what did he do? The Asher Lamelech says, what did he do? He what? Yeah, I thought you were saying something. Yeah, but the Asher Lamelech says, he reinstituted it as an obligation for everyone. Rabbi Ehrenreich says, no, what did he do? He didn't reinstitute it as an obligation, but he actually changed the language around so that people were davening something that made sense for them. It's very hard to say that in times of Bayit Sheni, they were davening for the korbanos to return, because they were already offering the korbanos. So that's what Shimon HaPikuli did. And I think that we finally have a satisfactory answer to our question from last week. Our question from last week, remember, was how we could have davened in Bayit Sheni times something that didn't seem to comport with what was going on in Bayit Sheni. And even though we saw some similar answers to this, as we discussed last time, there were various problems with those answers. Rabbi Aaron Reich says very clearly, they didn't. They didn't daven those tefillah. There's no kashya. And what Shimon HaPikuli did when he was master of the bracha is he changed it so that it would make sense for us. I'm very happy with this answer. I think it makes a lot of historical sense. I think it explains some loopholes and some big question marks in the historiography of the tefillah. And this is also the opinion of Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman in his Teshuvos Melamed L'Hawil, which we will see in one moment. So I just want to summarize in case anybody feels lost. We've been exploring tefillah and Shemona Esri in the aftermath of the destruction of the Second Temple. And we saw a few things. Number one, even before the temple was destroyed, tefillah was gaining in popularity, so that by the time the sacrifices were gone, there was not this dramatic shift in re-emphasis, or maybe not as dramatic of a shift in re-emphasis as we might have thought. Number two, we learned that after the temple was destroyed, Shimon HaPikuli was masdir the brachos of Shimon Esrei, and we looked at two explanations of what that means. Number one, the Asher Lamelech, he made Shimon Esrei obligatory. And number two, and this also explains the Gemara's clause that people forgot, because they weren't davening, they didn't have to. Two, Rav Chaim Yehuda Ehrenreich, Shimon changed the wording to comport with the language necessary to talk about Habeit HaMikdash, now destroyed. And this answers our question about how they davened in temple times for things that they still had. And the answer is that they didn't. We do now, but that's a new development. So there is one more very important development that happened in the decades following the destruction of the temple. And with this, we'll close. Although we call the Amidah the silent prayer or the Shemona Esrei, Shemona Esrei is Hebrew for 18. Shemona Esrei is Hebrew for 18. And it's named such after its 18 blessings. But the truth is, you'll notice if you were to open a Siddur, there are not 18 blessings in the Shemona Esrei. If you were, how many are there? 19. There are 19 blessings in the Shemona Esrei. And this is because although the Shemona Esrei was established by the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, you know, pending whatever Shimon HaPikuli did, whether it was obligatory at this point or not, it only had 18 blessings. It was later on, after the temple was destroyed, in the period that we are living in, meaning studying right now, that the sages in Yavne enacted an additional blessing, one that is still part of our Shemona Esrei today. Which blessing is it? Anybody know? What? Malshinim. Also the 12th, also called the 12th blessing, which is because it's the 12th blessing in Shemona Esrei, also called Birkat Haminim, the blessing of the heretics. It has been reprinted in source number 5 for your convenience, but we're not going to read it right now. But it basically is a bracha that prays for the downfall of the enemies of the wicked and of the heretics. So let's just read the Gemara that talks about the establishment of this bracha first. The Gemara in source number 6 in Brachos and Dav Chav Ched Amud Bet teaches Amar Rabbi Levi. Rabbi Levi said, Birkat Haminim B'Yavna Tiknuha. The Birkat Haminim was established in Yavne. Again, at the same time that all this stuff, all these other things were taking place in the aftermath of the destruction of the Second Temple. Tanu Rabbanon, Shimon HaPikuli Histir Shimona Esrei Brachot Lifnei Rabban Gamliel Al HaSeder B'Yavne. Right, we saw that from Megillah that Shimon HaPikuli was masdir the Shemona Esrei. Amar lehen Rabban Gamliel lechachamim. Rabban Gamliel said to these sages at that point, "Kulum yesh adam sheyodea letaken birkat haminim." Is there any person here who knows how to establish the blessing of the heretics, the birkat haminim v'lamal shinim? Amar Shmuel Hakatan v'tikna. Shmuel Hakatan, who was one of the most pious men of that generation, stood up and instituted it. What?
I can do it.
Yeah, exactly. The little engine that could. Literally, Shmuel HaKatan. So, Okay, so there are a lot of questions that one can ask here. First of all, why? Why did they institute this blessing? It says that they wanted to, but the Gemara doesn't give a reason. What was the reason that they needed to institute such a harsh bracha? Right? What was the reason for that? And number two, who are the heretics that are being referred to in this bracha? Who are we talking about here? So this is a good question, and it's one that we don't have time to answer fully, but I want to very briefly just read the remarks of Ismar Elbogen. Ismar Elbogen was a famous scholar. He was a German rabbi and historian, famous for his research and publications on the history of the Jewish liturgy. And this is from his book, aptly named Jewish Liturgy. And this is something he writes in that book. He basically, and he puts forth one opinion for how and why we arrived at Birkat Haminim. And I think, there's no Dvar Torah here, but I think as people who say Vilam Al Shinim quite frequently, it behooves us to know the history about what we're saying every single day. So he writes as follows. In source number, on the last, the top source on page number 3. The natural development of Christianity led to the increasing deification of J, meaning Jesus, and to the growing tendency to address him in prayer as a miracle worker. Add to this fact that the Christians came to be enemies of the Jewish nation, for in their desire to curry favor with the Romans, they denounced their former co-religionists, hence the words, I'm not going to pronounce, I don't yet, that's okay. Mosrin is really the Hebrew word for that. But they were informers, became synonym for Christians. The hope and the longing of the Jews was for the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem. But for the Christians, the destruction of the temple was a principal propaganda point. For them, God, by putting an end to the sacrifices, had in effect proclaimed his will that the law of Moses be abrogated. In any case, the beginning of the total break between Jews and Jewish Christians must be fixed at this period. An important step. So basically, what is happening? There are growing tensions between the Jews and the Christians in Bayit Sheni times and around the time of the destruction of the Second Temple. An important step in accomplishing the separation between Jews and the Christians was the expulsion of Christians from the synagogue. Now, you might not have thought of this, but the synagogue was a convenient base for missionary activities. It provided occasion for discussions of matters of faith and opinion, and excellent opportunities for disseminating propaganda. The Jewish Christians were among the most eager synagogue goers, and they even served as precentors, as mentioned above. It was necessary, basically, what would happen was, Jewish Christians were coming to the synagogue to preach Christianity to the Jews, and they were davening there. In fact, scholars point out that there's no reason to think that these Christians were not davening the Shemona Esrei that we were davening. Ah, so what happened? It was necessary to make this function distasteful to them, and to pressure them out of the synagogue. To achieve this end, Benediction 12 was introduced into the Amidah, and Shmuel HaKatan Samuel the Lesser established it according to the instructions of Rabban Gamliel. The petition for the annihilation of the sectarians was intended to expel them from the synagogue. So he writes that Birkat Haminim was created to discourage the Christians from attending the synagogue. Until Birkat Haminim was established, there was nothing heretical about the Shemona Esrei for Christians. Again, because especially because before Shimon HaPakuli made it rechange the language, there was nothing about sacrifices in the Shimon Esrei. They already had that, or maybe they said we want to keep the sacrifices. In this case, they would, but I don't know what it said. But Jewish Christians were coming to Shul and they were praying side by side among Jews. So in order to pressure them out of the synagogue, in order to say, you know, to make them feel uncomfortable, they specifically instituted a bracha against the Christians. And those are the heretics, he argues, that are being referred to in here. And that is why they established this bracha. It was to force them out of the Shul. Others have different opinions about this, but this is certainly a normative opinion among the scholars. And okay, any questions before we wrap up?
It's true.
They tell a story about there's a man who goes to his rabbi and he says, I really want to become a Kohen. And the rabbi says, I'm sorry, I can't make you a Kohen. It's not the kind of thing I can do. So he says, what do you say when your rabbi doesn't give you the answer you want? So I'll go to another rabbi. So he goes to another rabbi and he says, Rabbi, I want you to make me a Kohen. And the second rabbi says the same thing. You know, I can't make you a Kohen. You're either born a Kohen or you're not. He goes to the third. Anybody heard this joke before? He goes to the third rabbi. Third rabbi, he says, Rabbi, I want you to make me a Kohen. And the third rabbi says, I'm sorry, I can't make you a Kohen, but why do you want to be a Kohen so badly? He says, I really just want to be a Kohen. I'll give you a tremendous donation to the shul if you just make me a Kohen. And the rabbi said, but why do you want to be a Kohen? And he said, well, my father was a Kohen. My father's father was a Kohen. And I want to be a Kohen. And the joke is, and they accepted the donation. So we see two important developments to tefillah in the immediate post-temple era. Number one is the hasdara of Shemona Esrei, whatever that means. We looked at two different ideas for what that means. And the institution of Birkat Haminim. Both of these were very significant. They impact things that we do every single day. Maybe not all of us, many of us do every single day. And in any case, now that we have read the background on Birkat Haminim, I think we can close by reading this comment of the Melamed Lehoil, who essentially reiterates the statements of Rav Ehrenreich. The Melamed Lehoil was a fascinating sefer, written by a fascinating author, Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman. Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman was a German Orthodox Bible scholar and halachic authority. He was born in 1843. He was nifter in 1921. And he was very an ardent opponent of biblical criticism. He was also extremely learned, both religiously learned and according to the Wissenschaft movement in Germany. And he was able to joust with the academic scholars in his day, which was very important for a rabbi in Germany in those days to be able to do. And he says, V'lula de mistafina, which is an Aramaic way of saying, if I were not afraid, I would say, Hayiti mechadesh davar. I would suggest the following. Tzarich lomar da'afta anshei Knesset Hagadola tiknu yudchet brachot. Even though the men of the Great Assembly established 18 blessings, mikol makom eze brachot nishtanu michachamim she'acharav. It must be that later sages came and changed the language of those blessings, lefitzor chesman, according to what was needed at the times. Ukemoshe hosifu biyavne birkat haminim, keno hosifu gam kein benosach kitzat brachot lefitzor chesman beitot. And just as they established, just as they were able to add a blessing to Shemona Esrei, the blessing of the heretics, so too were they able to change the language away from what wouldn't have made sense for them to be saying in temple times, and they would change it. Okay, this is in Eben HaEzer and Choshen Mishpat, Chela Gimel, Simen Samet. Okay, so we see that even in the aftermath of the temple, Shemona Esrei continued to develop in important ways. As people who are charged with reciting Shemona Esrei, I think it behooves us to know, again, there's no Dvar Torah here, but I think it's just important to know these things about our history and about what we do. So next week we'll pick up with how we got from there to here. We'll talk about the proliferation of the Nusach. We'll answer the question, does that mean that the text of Shemona Esrei that we say today dates back to Shimon HaPikuli? And if it does, well then, which community is right? Because there are different communities with different texts. Who's right? Who's actually correct? And then that we'll discuss next week. And in 2 weeks' time, that's what we'll discuss in 2 weeks' time because we meet every other week. And then that will lead us naturally into our first halachic discussion about whether one can change the nusach of Shemona Esrei and what one should do if they find themselves in a community or in a minyan that is davening a different nusach than they are. Thank you all for coming. It's a pleasure to learn together. As always, I have to run out, but please, if you want to keep your source sheets, you can. Otherwise, you can just leave them up here. Thank you very much.